This is my bucket. It's plastic. I'd like to have one of those galvanized metal ones. Those are real buckets, but nevertheless, it's my bucket. Inside is my list, which makes it my bucket list. Now, as bucket lists go, there aren't a lot of things in there on that list of things I want to do before I die. You know, I'm grateful that there are some things that I have been able to check off. For instance, I married a wonderful, pleasant to the eyes woman that I did not deserve, even do not deserve. I went to Ireland and Scotland. I preached at annual conference. I spent 3 weeks alone in the Ontario wilderness, which was something that I wanted to do ever since I watched Walt Disney when I was a kid. Let's see what else. Oh, I've zipped lying down mountains in Maui, and I went deep sea fishing. I white water rafted on a class 5 river with my son in Idaho. What else? Oh, and I have been to concerts, who knows how many, to hear some of the world's greatest musicians and bands. You know, I'm really a fortunate guy. Now, there are other things on this list, and I know that I do not have time to do them all. And as Sue would remind me, I do not have the necessary resources to do them all. But say, I'm going to give it a try. I want to go to Antarctica. Sue doesn't. I want to fish in this wild, awesome, beautiful river in Alaska, fish for those salmon, and to see huge brown bears on the other shore doing the same. And Sue doesn't. I want a lakeside cabin in Wisconsin. I want to go on an eating tour of dives, some of the best ones in every state. I want to write a book. And if it doesn't win a Pulitzer Prize, that's okay. I want to go on a moose hunt in northern Saskatchewan. Don't ask me why Saskatchewan, other than they have a lot of moose there. I want to go on a guided moose hunt, and I'm going to mount the head, and I'm going to hang it on my living room wall. We'll see what my wife has to say about that. One more thing on that bucket list. I want to play the guitar in a concert with Paul McCartney. Now, is that too ambitious or what? What's on your bucket list? Just stand up and shout. One thing that's on your bucket list that you want to do before you die. Marty.
Visit Australia.
Visit Australia. Yeah.
Swimming with dolphins.
The Miami Dolphins or? Oh, okay. Who else? What do you want to do? Okay. Now that's a doable one. And that's something to work for. See Russell go through college and graduate. What else?
I'd like to meet
I'm sorry, say it again.
Oh,
he's the world championship yo-yo trick guy? No. I know who you're talking about. Dave, what's on your bucket list? You'd like to meet which one? The current one? Yeah, that's one of the things on my list, too. Keep coming. What's on your list?
Visit every country in the
Visit every country in the world. You better start now, honey. That brings up a good point, and I'll get to that. Come on now. Lori, you've checked off a lot of yours. I mean, you've slept at the base of Mount Kilimanjaro. You've gone to Iceland. And that's just since I've been here. And you have taken a trip to Auschwitz.
Eyes on Everest.
Eyes on Everest, okay. I heard that on average it costs $64,000 to do that, by the way. Ruth, what's on your bucket list?
I would like to see all the kids, grandkids, and all my extended ones be sure to know God.
Okay. All of the extended family, that they would come to know God in, doesn't matter how. Doesn't matter how it's expressed, but that's a wonderful thing. I'll take one more. What is on your bucket list? To help people.
Stay healthy until I'm 100.
Okay, you're on track for 100. Okay. I just have to tell you, you're not really in control of that, but you can wish it and you can hope it. You know, to live a life worth living, we have to have goals. We have to have dreams. Now, some people have some rather odd kind of dreams that are on their list. A group of people was asked the same question that I asked you. Here were some of the responses. I would buy a Corvette and completely floor it on a long, straight, empty stretch of road. I would max out my credit card on a world cruise. They could sell off my estate to pay it off, burn my body, and scatter it to the winds. Yeah, that sounds nice. I would take a nap with my dog in the sunlight of an afternoon just to know the sweetness of sleep. I would wake up every morning feeling the sun on my skin and the air in my lungs. I would take long, inspiring walks in the oldest woods I can find. I would laugh at every joke, and I would smile at every stranger. A life worth living needs to have a goal and to have a dream, but as we all know, that dreams alone won't cut it. You have to work for them, and not everything on the bucket list is worth pursuing. Because you see, it's when it finally comes down to it, it's not what we want, it's what we should do. It's asking the question, what are the needs around me and in this world that intersect with my abilities? Because when the last call comes and we depart this earth, we're going to walk through a door that says accounts receivable. And there we are going to give an account for how we used the time that was entrusted to us, the time which someone said is the raw, unmanufactured material of the universe. And if we didn't get around to doing it, we're going to be asked why we didn't get around to doing it. What if you had just one precious year to live? How would you use it? You know, time is in limited supply. It is so precious. And what are you doing right now with it? Are you spending it doing something meaningful, or are you keeping up with the Kardashians? When you're with your family, are you focused on them, or are you texting? Are you in worship on Sunday morning and connecting in meaningful ways with your brothers
and sisters in the family of faith, or are you reading the Sunday Journal Gazette at Starbucks? Are you killing your time keeping up with the celebrities in People magazine? Or you spend time in a good book, or with the good book, knowing something about the direction and purpose of life? This is a confession, and I will tell you that my wife and my family are concerned about me. And I know some of you would say they should have been concerned about you long before this. And especially what my wife is telling me is that you are not here. What do you mean I'm not here? She said, you are not here. Your body is here, but your brain is somewhere else. And I guess I've always had that sense that I'm a little bit disjointed. But I wasn't aware that it was that obvious to my family, because you see, I spend too much time in the future thinking ahead to all the work that has to be done and how I'm going to manage to do it. I think ahead to certain challenges and what are the scenarios of how that's going to play out, and I'm anxious when I think about that, and yes, when I worry about that, trying to have some control and having plan A, B, C, and D to do it. But you see, that's living in the future. That means my body may be present, but my mind is somewhere else. And I forget that it is not God, David, who is in control of the world, but it is God, oh me of little faith. And you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Because you live either in the past or with me. You're out there somewhere in the future. And maybe some of you are fortunate enough to spend some time, just a little bit of time in the present. See, there's nothing like knowing you're dying to get you serious about living. And the Apostle Paul's life is a template for focusing upon what matters most while we're staring death in the face. Paul is writing these two letters to his young protege in ministry, Timothy. They were written while Paul was behind bars in a Roman prison. The church was under intense persecution from the Emperor Nero, and these two letters of Paul were probably the last ones he wrote before he was executed. Paul didn't know when the guards would come to escort him to the execution. They could come at any time of the day or night, and so Paul was always in a preparation mode. He conducted himself in the way he had done it ever since he was blasted silly by Christ on the Damascus Road, who said, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And in 2 Timothy 4:5, Paul says, always be sober, endure suffering, do the work of an evangelist, and carry out your ministry fully. It was a charge for Timothy to do what Paul had done. And he said, my life is already being poured out as a libation, for the time of my departure has come. Can anybody tell me what a libation is? It's not something you order at a bar. I'll tell you that right now. A libation is a cup whose contents have been poured out in a sacrificial rite. And Paul is saying that as his life has come to an end, he has tried to be faithful until the last drop. He poured it out completely for the cause of Jesus, the cause that Jesus had given him. He dealt with his impending death by knowing that Jesus, whom he had persecuted, had forgiven him and loved him and remained faithful to him and would be with him to the end and beyond. There were no regrets at the last call. And Paul could endure it all because of his faithfulness and Christ's faithfulness, and there were no regrets. For he said, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Therefore, there is prepared for me a crown of righteousness, which the righteous judge will award me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. Over 35 years of doing funerals, I've observed a lot of different family behaviors. When death comes, you can sometimes put the families in one of two categories. There are those who make the comments like, I'm grateful that I could say what I needed to say. For the first time, we were able to say what we really meant to one another. I forgave my mom for the way she treated me as a child. After all of these years, Dad finally said he loved me. I will miss her terribly, but I will have peace because I know that there is no unfinished business. There are no loose ends because it has all been tied together. There is no regret, not one. And then there are other families who go around saying, coulda, woulda, shoulda. I didn't spend the time with Mom the way I should have. He died before I could say I was sorry. I intended to tell him the next time. You know, I don't really remember if I ever said I loved her. I thank my mom for being a great mom, even though for all those years, I was a terrible jerk to her. You know, some families have collective grief for the things left unsaid and undone. And you know what I'm talking about, don't you? Because all of us have experienced some of both. You know, as I was preparing this message, I realized that over the span of my ministry, I have always enjoyed ministering to older people. And the reason I enjoy it is because they are wise. Okay, well, not all of them, but some of them are wise, and the wisdom comes from a lifetime experience. And it is also forged in that awareness that we don't have all the time to do everything we want as we want. Perhaps they are no longer walking straight but stooped over. Perhaps their physical abilities are diminishing. Perhaps their eyesight is failing, but not their insight of what really matters. And they will tell you that it is not our stuff, it is not our social security, it is not the first alert that we wear that can give us security when we fall down, and it is not found in all the toys that we are told will secure our happiness. They say you wise up. And you pay attention to what's important, and you forget all of the rest. How many of you know anything about John Donne? I think that's how you pronounced it, D-O-N-N-E. He was the dean of St. Paul's Cathedral in London in the early 1600s. And it was during his tenure that three waves of the Black Plague swept through the city. And on that third wave, a third of the population died. Over 40,000 people, entire neighborhoods had become ghost towns. And people were coming from all over London on Sunday to hear what John Doane had to say about the meaning of all of this and why God would allow it to happen and how we cling to our faith in such a time of travail. And of course, because of his ministering to so many people, John Doane himself was stricken with the plague. And lying in his bed at home, he heard the tolling of the funeral bell in the neighboring church. And he heard that bell day and night. And he lay there for 6 weeks, wondering how near death he was. And he imagined that he was passing from this life into the next with all of the dead. And those weeks in isolation and solitude really intensified that morbid fascination. And it was made worse knowing that the people around him didn't want to get close to him for fear that they would become sick as well. John Doane was convinced that all of these people were making the bell ring in order to hasten his departure. And during this terrible time, John Doane wrote some of the most quoted, memorable words in all of poetry. See if you don't remember. "Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved in humankind, and therefore never send to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And it will. Yes, it will. It's guaranteed. It will toll for all of us." I read about a man in Utah who died of pancreatic cancer back in 2006. And knowing that his last call would come sooner or later, he wrote at a torrid pace. He wrote letters and essays and poems. And I want you to listen carefully to these words from a piece he titled "Full Measure." "I measure my life in my family, who speak through tears and who serve my meal on a wicker tray, who pray and love and float. I measure my life in pine siskins who entertain me in the bird feeder outside my window, and Gus the schnauzer who curls up beside me in bed. I measure my life in friends who do not know my sins, who hug my shrunken body, who break open my heart with their words. I measure my life in cancer that has taught me how to measure my life." At funerals, I often share a verse from the Psalms. "O Lord, teach us to measure our days so we may gain hearts of wisdom." And so how do you measure your life? Not by how long you've managed to hang around, but by the manner in which you have hung around, by the manner of your living and your loving and your giving. And if you doubt me, just go talk to Herb. Once he's up and around and on good terms with his titanium hip. You know, Herb has undergone a series of rebirths over the last several months as he and as Ruth have spent a lot of time with Robin LaRue. Sometimes sitting in silence, sometimes talking about trivial things, sometimes talking about deep things, all of the things that make up our lives. A couple of weeks ago, Herb told me he did something that he had never done before. He fed someone. You see, Robin has no control over anything now, except his breathing and his speaking, and now his challenge of swallowing. He and Herb have this thing going on that Herb brings in Sloppy Joe's, or he brings in Szechuan chicken. After the service, asked me what I brought him several months ago when he could still have it. Herb said, I fed somebody for the first time, and what a humbling thing that was to have this poor soul laying there, and you have to put each morsel of food in his mouth. And he said, the tears were welling up in my eyes, and the tears were welling up in Robin's eyes. And I said, you know what you're doing. You know what you did, don't you? You're experiencing communion at its very deepest level. When the last call comes for Herb, he will walk through the accounts receivable door, being able to give maybe not what he feels, but what we know is a splendid account of service, to go into a situation for which he was a complete foreigner, and to be able to have his heart cracked open and his tear ducts unclogged, and to be able to experience what truly makes life meaningful. A libation is not something you order at a bar. The last call is not something you hear when the bar is closing. For ask not for whom the bell tolls. Together it tolls for thee.